Welcome again, all lovers of liberty. It's another Liberty Hour with Liberty Southwest coming from you from the Southwest metropolitan area of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Tonight we are joined with Eric Taylor, Danny Ning, Chelsea Camo, Lydia Tabbitt, myself, Kirk Pettis, and Blake Anderson is joining us as well tonight. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. Very good.
Awesome.
Tonight's topic is going to be cryptocurrency.
That's Woo-hoo! Right.
A recurring theme lately.
Interesting topic.
And there's a lot happening every month lately, so I think this will be forever a recurring theme. And I love talking about it, and Blake Anderson has a lot of knowledge behind cryptocurrencies, and why don't you introduce yourself, Blake?
Well, my name is Blake Anderson. I have an educational background in math-based security and computer science. I studied with MIT. I worked for a Fortune 25 financial institution as an information technology project manager for encryption and cryptographic services until I read about Bitcoin. And then I quit my job to work full-time with developing the Bitcoin protocol and promoting the currency. And I have now given myself the job title of cryptographic economist. So I try to basically do what I just described.
It's pretty awesome. Now, what is cryptocurrency exactly? Do you have a good way to phrase it?
Well, what cryptocurrency is very, very, very big. As you were saying just a few moments ago, we talk about cryptocurrency more and more on the show. It seems to be a recurring theme. And I was trying to illustrate to somebody the other day that people are like, oh, I'm tired of you talking about cryptocurrency all the time. To me, cryptocurrency and the implications that come along with it are bigger almost than everything else that's ever happened in reality. So it's almost like everybody's walking around talking about their ass, and you come around and you say, well, let's talk about my face and the rest of my body and stuff like that. And they're like, well, why don't you keep talking about your ass? It's like, well, I want to talk about some new stuff that is going to explore beyond the realm of everybody, you know, focusing on asses all the time. Let's try to elevate the conversation and talk about something that has some bigger and more serious implications on a much wider scale. So what is cryptocurrency? Well, what it really is, if I had to put it into a box, would be it is a new language that is able to communicate value to one another without the latitude of corruption and theft and inflation and deflation on purpose to create basically speculator markets and do other things that really, really have been some of the most pernicious features of having a, quote, free market subject to capture and regulation by state control.
It's a lot to chew on.
It is.
But coming from a liberty activist here, we have been against debt-ridden currencies as the Federal Reserve dollar, U.S. dollar is produced. And, yeah, so this always piques our interest. But most people in the libertarian world all view gold-backed currencies as the way to go. How do you think cryptocurrency differs from why do you think cryptocurrency is the future versus a gold-backed currency?
Well, I think that gold is an extremely fantastic store of value. It's done very, very, very well in history. I'm not anti-gold by any stretch of the imagination. Gold is a great way to diversify. Diversification is an extremely important feature of managing your wealth and investing and doing different things, because otherwise you don't mitigate and minimize risk that you are experienced and exposed to. So that's not a very good situation. So diversification into stable stores of value is extremely important. And this being said, gold is really good for doing that. The problem with gold, in my opinion, is that it went from being a default-free currency, which means I've got gold. Nobody can go default on gold. I have it. So it's gone from that, which is really cool, to now there's this giant paper COMEX market with way more paper gold chasing after gold than there actually is enough to back it up. And when that continues to deteriorate, as it is going to, it's a mathematical fact, that's going to create a COMEX default. Now, this isn't really a fun thing to talk about, and it makes me sad, too. I'm not excited about this happening. But when that happens and there's a COMEX default, that will be more or less the day that the death of the dollar starts to have rubber really hit the road and stuff really starts to take off and things get bad. When this happens, the various different nations around the world are going to say, well, our fiat currencies, our ink and paper, by decree, currencies aren't going to work anymore to pay our bills because nobody wants them. And what's going to happen is they're going to liquidate massive stores of platinum, palladium, gold, and different things like that. And I think that markets will unfortunately be flooded by an attempt to go back to the way that things were while there is this new platform or value of language through digital stores of value and digital currencies. And I think that people that are holding lots of stores of physical gold might end up getting burned and having it be the opposite effect of the diversification that they are trying to achieve and that they have achieved through very much research on their own. I mean, these are not ignorant people that are ignoring advice or anything. They're actually going with the best advice that they have available. And I think that it'll be terrible when all that gold hits the market.
Oh, so you see gold flooding the market as a form of redeeming capital? And that causing, you know, systemic problems within the financial system? Is that?
Well, I think that when the problems with the financial system really become apparent to the extent where the common person can't ignore them anymore is when there's a COMEX default in the precious metals market. That is going to be very, very, very hard to cover up and to mask and to amelioration of that level of damage is a very, very difficult thing for me to even conceive of. So that concerns me.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see what the Chinese government is doing in relation to gold. It certainly looks like they're trying to position themselves as eventually, really providing the commodity backing to be a potential reserve currency.
I agree with that assessment completely. And India and China are both really, really, really getting into the game of having gold around and using gold and making gold as used and traded as possible. I mean, there's vending machines in China where you can buy various pieces and sizes of gold for money. So India and China are set up to trade with one another in lots of gold. I mean, there's a reason why diamonds aren't really a currency. It's because they are too concentrated in various different areas. They don't really have the spread out advantage that gold does. So we don't have a lot of gold left in America. You're right. China's really gobbling it all up, and so is India. So I think that even our regulators and legislators and representatives, our dear representatives, I think that they know that if we want to have a race to go back to a gold-backed currency, we are losing that race and that we probably need to find a new way to go, even if we wanted to play that game.
And that also really factors into the COMEX shenanigans, right? Trying to maintain what looks to be a stable value to the dollar by, you know, going, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, continuing to grow short positions on the commodities, right? That's
yes, and this will all exactly contribute to a situation wherein the value of the dollar is fluctuating so much that the commercial exchange markets are going to start to be like, let me hold off on all of my activity for about 15 minutes and see what happens after that, because it's actually going to be really valuable for me because the price of this different thing is going up so much and going down so much. So then when, you know, lots and lots of different analysts or people or systems start to do that, because it's advantageous and it starts to really, really sink the dollar, there's not a whole lot to stop it from sinking at this point, and they're going to have to print money, which doesn't really solve the problem anyway. And that day on which people start to reserve trading activity because it's advantageous to do so, and when that becomes a ripple effect, that is basically like the last, you know, straw on our global economy's back. It's going to be something that was worse than when there was just a depression in America or somewhere else or localized bad management of money. The global debt crisis is some serious business.
Yeah, and that I imagine that's probably what makes cryptocurrency so interesting to you, because it's almost a ray of light. You know, obviously it's in kind of the first stages. You know, Bitcoin is, you know, a little over 4 years old. There are fits and starts. There are certainly vulnerabilities to the software and other altcoin software. But it would be very helpful if and when we start to deal with the lack of confidence in fiat currencies in general. It's a fiat currency or cryptocurrencies are fiat when you're talking about about them, but they're limited, right? So you, by design, Bitcoin or any of the other cryptocurrencies really have, I mean, there's a finite supply that can be created, right?
Yeah, definitely. There's a very tightly controlled, 20, 21 million limit for the amount of Bitcoins that could be mined. That last Bitcoin will be mined in 2140. I mean, this stuff has been laid down in concrete and hashed into the most permanent math-based security that, you know, has ever come along on Earth. I mean, there's, you know, now newer math-based security codes are going to be, you know, more robust, but it's not like, oh, SHA-256B, which is what the hashing algorithm that Bitcoin uses, it's not like, oh, that's going to be cracked next year. It's extremely secure. It's extremely stable. And these rules that you were talking about as far as limits of supply are, you know, coded into the core of the Bitcoin protocol, the 55 lines of Python code that give birth to the blockchain and create the actual hash chain.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, or let's listen to a clip. This is a high-level introductory clip on what cryptocurrency is. It may get dry at points, but it's very informative. And if you guys want to cut it, just let me know. But I think it's a good clip. It's a little bit longer. It's 6 minutes and 24 seconds. But we can listen to the clip and comment on it and continue the conversation after. So I'll,
yeah, we can pause it any time and continue on and throw.
Absolutely. So I'll start it here.
Welcome to NCIX Tech Tips. Today's episode is all about those cryptocurrencies that you've been hearing so much about. There are a ton of them floating around now. Everyone wants a piece of the pie, but the main ones are Bitcoin, Litecoin, Purecoin, Namecoin, and Dogecoin, and Catcoin. Actually, no, I'm just kidding about those last two. They do really exist. In fact, people are making money on Catcoin at the moment. But anyway, those four first ones are sort of the more relevant ones. We're going to give you a rundown about this cryptocurrency thing and what it's all about. So at the most basic level, these cryptocurrencies are really no different than the money that you have in your wallet. Similar to this money in my wallet, it has no intrinsic value. It's just bits of data, whereas this is just pieces of paper. You can't actually really do much with
it. We should stop this right now.
Throw it in there like a rap star, or like, you know, strike menace.
Sure.
We need to have a discussion about intrinsic value, because it's you were kind of hinting at it, and then he was talking about it, and intrinsic value is a very, very important discussion relative to Bitcoin, because people perceive it as what separates Bitcoin from other things. Now, intrinsic value, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people will disagree with me on this, but kind of my trick to explaining what intrinsic value is to people is, what would be worth it for you to have if there was no one left on Earth except for you? What has intrinsic value? And then people say, well, nothing has intrinsic value. Well, that's not really true either. Food has intrinsic value. Water has intrinsic value. And also subjugation.
Shelter.
Yeah, shelter. Subjugation and control over other human beings has intrinsic value. So that kind of falls outside of, the last person on Earth scenario, because, you know, of course, you couldn't be the last person on Earth to be subjugating other human beings, but there are a few things that do have intrinsic value. Now, this is where a lot of people will disagree with me, but I believe that information has intrinsic value. if somebody were to say, hey, entire world, we'll either give you all the information that you need to explore space, like Star Trek style, or a giant boulder of gold, what would we pick?
The information.
Anybody that didn't want to pick the information, we should probably deal with that, because that wouldn't be good. But information does have intrinsic value. And what is in the blockchain? The blockchain has information in it. And not just in the abstract, obscure way of, it's technically information, even though it's all hashed out and it's all, garbly-gook jumble that nobody can read because it's secure. There are actual pieces of information that can be included and put into the Bitcoin blockchain, including contracts, and pretty much the sky is the limit. So having a permanent, regularly audited, non-changeable, non-modifiable, non-revisionist version of history is something that has never happened before. It's not just that it's never happened before, nothing like it has ever happened before. The internet is getting there, and the internet is becoming a more kind of permanent version of history, but actually having something akin to a giant billboard in space where you can put whatever information you want and launching nukes at it doesn't do anything, that's exciting. So that's value to me.
Well, the only
one thing I thought about, and actually I was thinking about you, Kirk, and I was doing a little research on the similarities between tally sticks and Bitcoin. And there are similarities there, where tally sticks were used in Great Britain from what, around 1200 up until really central banks took hold in the 1750s, 1760s, where, unique information was inscribed on sticks, in almost like a blockchain-like fashion. And you couldn't forge it. It's almost a crude form of cryptography. It's unique to the digital age, but there have been successful similar rudimentary technologies that have existed in the past and have functioned as a form of fiat in a very successful way.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the term fiat means it doesn't mean fake or false or shenaniganerial. It means by decree. There's the element of coercive force to prevent both counterfeiting and competition. So if we want to call Bitcoin a fiat and we really want to be true to exactly what that means, you cannot really put that label on it. There is disagreement about what people mean when they say fiat. Some people use it to mean, frivolous order or really that kind of is what it means. But if we want to be super specific, and in computer science, semantics are of material importance or code doesn't work, we want to be very, very, very sure that we have the true etymologically correct definitions of anything that we're going to apply to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is so new that it transcends almost every single word that we've ever come up with, which is why it's so hard to explain.
Right.
Should we just continue on the clip?
Sure.
Yep, definitely.
Let's go for it. All right.
Thanks.
Here you go.
Poses and hold large wads of it or whatever else you want to do. It also bears some similarity to commodities like gold or diamonds, though, so there's no central bank that controls it. And keeping with that theme of no control, like gold and diamonds, it can be sent directly from user to user without any credit card companies, banks, or other intermediaries. Now, unlike, also similar to gold, but unlike the wrapped status paper, you can't just print a bunch of a cryptocurrency. They need to be mined. So at the heart of Bitcoin, for example, there is a mathematical problem. Users solve these problems with high-end computer parts graphics cards are better than CPUs, and beyond those are ASIC cards. And every time a solution to the problem is found, there is a reward given in the form of a Bitcoin. Now, the difficulty of this math problem varies with the strength of the network, so that the solutions are found at regular intervals, every 10 minutes on average. The reward also varies, or the reward itself also varies, except it is tied to a four-year scale, which started at 10.5 million coins in the first year, and then will halve. Now, eventually, we're going to reach the upper limit of 21 million bitcoins, and after that, like gold, once we run out of it, we can't mine more. And the theory is that bitcoins will become more expensive as they become more rare, and people eventually lose them. I mean, once you lose a wallet full of bitcoins, those bitcoins are gone forever. But don't worry, guys, there is a saving grace. Unlike normal currency that can only make smaller denominations like pennies and dollars, bitcoins can actually be divided up to 8 decimal places. So 0.0000001 bitcoin would be the smallest denomination of bitcoin. That's how even with a bitcoin hovering at, you know, anywhere between $500 to $1,500 Canadian, depending on the time of day and, you know, what's going on out there in the market, you can still just use a fraction of that to pay for a pack of gum, for example. It's not like, oh, well, do you have change for $700 for this packet? No, it's not like that. Now, the way that bitcoins are stored is in a virtual wallet, which basically keeps a unique record of every single transaction and also allows you to send and receive bitcoins. All transactions are also verified by the miners, and that record is permanently stored by all members of the network. So that means that transactions can take a few minutes in order to complete and verify that it has actually gone through. So that is the general idea behind Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies really as a whole, but what about all these other cryptocurrencies? We've mostly talked about Bitcoin so far. Well, there are three main ones: Litecoin, Purecoin, and Namecoin. Litecoins are the second biggest cryptocurrency right now, with the main advantage, I guess, being that they're a lot cheaper, they're easier to mine, and they're also about 4 times faster when completing a transaction. Speaking of them being easier to mine, Litecoin is also ASIC resistant, which means that ASIC cards and machines that are special pieces of hardware that are built simply to mine cryptocurrency faster is not that effective on it. Now, speaking of ASICs, let's talk a little bit about what those are. So for Bitcoin particularly, because it's not ASIC resistant, ASIC cards and machines are special pieces of hardware that are built simply to mine Bitcoin way faster than even the highest end consumer grade hardware. So to put it in perspective, the fastest video card produces between 1 to 2 kilo hash, which is the unit of measurement for how quickly you can calculate cryptocurrency. So these dedicated cards, compared to 1.2 kilohash, can produce up to 1,500 gigahash at power consumptions that are much lower. Power consumption is one of the major costs of mining bitcoins, because you have to have the hardware working extremely hard. So essentially, Litecoins, when I say ASIC resistant, it means that they are much harder to make dedicated hardware for, and GPUs, graphics cards, remain the most efficient way to mine them. And that makes them much more accessible than the $2,000-plus ASIC monster dedicated hardware. And in addition to that, you can actually use your graphics card for other things. So it's more for real people, normal people. Now, all the other currencies have their unique spin, but I won't bog you too much down with all of that. Just check out the description to learn more about them. But in summary, bitcoins are a virtual currency, which, like we said, is not really that different from a paper currency. This is sort of virtual value as well. You can mine them with high-end computer parts or ASIC miners. There are a maximum of 21 million bitcoins out there, 12 million of which have already been found, and all the transactions are publicly and anonymously stored. Now, stay tuned tomorrow, guys, because we are going to go over exactly how to build a Bitcoin mining rig, if this little video here has piqued your interest, what you might need, and we're going to show off.
So that gives a pretty decent high-level overview as to what Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are kind of all about.
Most definitely, and I apologize for jumping in. It's just that economics are more or less a soft science. So when he was doing an introduction to his just fantastic technical explanation, I had to jump in and say, well, you know, economics are kind of a soft science. This is really more of what our crowd is going to think about this perspective as opposed to maybe a more state-oriented crowd.
Right, right. So one of the things that I've noticed over the last, you know, and this comes up more and more with people who haven't really been aware of cryptocurrency, and they just kind of read, you know, what they see in the USA Today or Business Week or whatever, is the volatility issue, the software vulnerability issue, specifically with Bitcoin wallets being stolen, with Bitcoin exchanges being hacked, and Bitcoins being stolen from there, what I say is it's a new technology. There are going to be bugs. There are going to be exploits. And when you're talking about exchanges, you're not talking about the Bitcoin software. You're talking about a vendor technology or vendor software that is written by individuals who aren't even participating in Bitcoin or any of the other altcoin software initiatives.
Exactly. And I actually have kind of a fun thing that I like to say about this whenever there's an article that's just terribly researched that says, you know, Bitcoin hacked. And then, you know, somebody's, you know, wallet password was found out because it was weak or they gave it away or whatever. Or Bitcoin exchange got hacked, which I always say is kind of like, okay, there's a whole bunch of kids in a park and they all have tables and they're all selling and trading pogs. Mm-hmm. Somebody runs up and steals one of those kids' tables, that's not an issue with pogs. I mean, that's insane. So I actually like to reconstruct the argument that they make and to illustrate how absurd it is. To say that Bitcoin has been hacked as a result of a theft of a Bitcoin wallet hosting website or something like that is the same thing as saying when a bank gets robbed, instead of saying the bank was robbed and cash was stolen, to report that these people got a hold of the serialized U.S. dollar index and the actual printing plates, and they can make as much money as they want, and no one will ever be able to tell the difference. And, of course, that's not at all what happens when a bank is robbed. So, I mean, it's to that level of ridiculousness when claims like that are made.
Yeah, and to me that, and I don't know, you probably know quite a bit more about this than I do, that financial institutions in the United States, the FDIC essentially backs up your savings or checking account up to $200,000. They're really, you know, in the instance of Mt. Gox and some of the other exchanges that have been hacked, there are no, to my knowledge, there are no equivalent private entities that offer that type of insurance. And that seems to be a business opportunity that hasn't been, you know, realized up to this point.
I agree, and I think that would be a great business opportunity, but it would be very, very, very quickly eclipsed by the utility of the blockchain to make various insurance policies and situations and automatically enforceable contracts that will make a lot of legal dispute exploration and litigation almost non-existent going forward.
So is this something to be built into the blockchain? And it'd probably be helpful for, you know, you to give a when talking about a blockchain or when talking about Bitcoin wallets or, you know, anything along those lines to explain, because really what the blockchain is, it's a record of all Bitcoin transactions, correct?
Yep, it's a technical term for the ledger that is displaying where all of the Bitcoins are. And I guess I should make a distinction. There is Bitcoin, the currency, which is called BTC very frequently, almost like a stock ticker symbol. And then there's the Bitcoin protocol and code platform, the 55 lines of Python code that has BIPs submitted to it, or Bitcoin improvement plans, that is controlled by 5 different constituencies of core developers. And then that Python code barfs out the Genesis block, which is the first piece of the blockchain. And the blockchain, like you said, is this actual big kind of ledger, like I said, floating in space where things can either be public or private based upon how you want to conduct business.
Right. And the groups all operate within the Bitcoin Foundation, correct?
No, different groups and different developers can work however they want, doing whatever they want. They can interface with the foundation relative to implementing a feature set if it's valuable for Bitcoin. But Bitcoin works pretty well. I mean, there's right now a lot of latitude to work with the protocol, and there are companies all over the world actively investing massive amounts of capital to developing Bitcoin technology.
Right. Can we back up for a second?
Sure. Yeah.
Cryptocurrency, what is the mathematics behind it or the algorithms utilized, and what, I guess, what makes it crypto? What is there a basic definition to go around that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, this kind of gets back into mining and what mining is. And at first, I guess as an example, if you guys, do you guys remember way back in the day when you could download a peer-to-peer program to do gene folding or protein folding for cancer cure research? So you would have your computer just whirring along all night, submitting all these different folding tests to this giant, quote, botnet or bot network. That's a pretty cool idea. I don't know how effective that is for curing cancer. I did it for a while. I never really did a lot of research on it. Hopefully it's working out. But so
that's always what I thought the mining was, that it was solving some great thing out there that needed research instead of just a simple math problem to solve it and be done with it, as the mining concises of.
So what they're actually doing is there was a little bit of a jump in the explanation video. The quote miners, or people that are generating these hash equations and things like that, are doing multiple things. They're securing the blockchain. They are mining for Bitcoin by solving these mathematical problems, and then they are also verifying transactions and auditing the network. They have a multitude of different jobs, and even when all the Bitcoins are mined, the network will continue to verify transactions and audit the blockchain on a continual basis.
What do you mean secure the blockchain?
Securing the blockchain requires basically now ASICs, the application-specific integrated circuits, to use a very specific gate array to hash through encryption protocols. So what does that mean to hash through an encryption protocol? Well, basically encryption is going to have a few different parts. To encrypt something is to basically take it from something that's readable and to obscure it so that it can't be read or recognized. So doing that is a process that can be undone if you know what was used to obscure it. So we try to find processes that are really easy to do one way and take a long time to do the other way. Things like inverse phi functions and phi math and things like that. If you're, you know, a nerd like me, you can look that up and it's some interesting stuff. So what happens is there's an encryption algorithm applied by the hashing of these ASIC machines. So it's going to obscure the data with encryption, and then it's going to add something called salt to that. So basically adding salt to the encryption is adding an additional modifier that's unique to that one specific equation that makes it even harder to undo. Now, I could keep going on in more technical depth about what's going on, but basically things similar to this are done enough that undoing Bitcoin hashing would take just an absolutely insurmountable amount of computing power, a hypermassive length of time.
Well, it's like adding symbols to a password or something, that it can't be just
exactly.
It can't be letters, and then you add numbers and then symbols just make it more password protective or whatnot.
Yeah, and what's being go ahead.
Oh, well, the more and more I talk to people and I get pretty excited telling them about Bitcoin, the one thing that I'm often asked is, you know, how do you know it can't be hacked? And I hear you saying, you know, well, it'd take, you know, forever and ever to do this. But we've seen the leaps and bounds that have happened in technology in the past decade. And if we're talking about a currency that we're not just trying to use for the next decade or the next couple of decades, what's to say that that technology won't come about in the next 100 years? And I'm not a skeptic of Bitcoin, but this has been the one thing I haven't really been able to explain well.
So, no, it's a very good and important question, and I'm very glad that you asked it. Basically, there's a strong element of risk management and risk mitigation involved in math-based security. So when I worked for this Fortune 25 financial institution, it was kind of more or less my job. They said, here are the digital keys. They're very, very, very expensive. You need to lock all of our virtual doors with them in a way that nobody knows what they are and that everything goes smoothly and all that kind of stuff. And a part of the way that that's done is through a project that is very, very heavy with risk management. To the extent that math-based security risk management asks, if all computing power in a general given area were applied to X purpose, how long would it take before a reasonable assumption of them getting close to breaking it, like how long is all that going to take? We take that amount of time and we always change encryption before that amount of time comes to pass. Now, when you have something that's not just encrypted but hashed with extra protocols, it takes the amount of time. Like, let's say we find the prime factorization of 694,213,000. Finding the prime factorization of that requires a lot of guesswork. You have to go down until you guess and go back and forth to find the prime factorization. A computer can do it a lot faster than a person, but even on a computer, if you start to do basically inverse phi functions or really, really much more convoluted math, you can see, okay, look, the processor took, 25 nanoseconds to do the first one. It took 50 nanoseconds to do the second one. It took 5 minutes after that. It took 10 minutes after that. And the amount of time that it takes to undo the amount of computing power that is in the Bitcoin network goes up into space. It's like billions of years would be required. So yes, computers are always getting more and more and more powerful, and that could upset Moore's law and come through in a way that risk management really wasn't expecting. But the protocol could be reworked, and measures could be taken to basically continue to secure the blockchain.
So then you say that additional measures could be taken, and who would that be? The owner of the Bitcoin could, modify it or put extra passwords on there. Or when you say they could modify it, who would be they? Because from my understanding, there's not like a CEO of Bitcoin. There's no one running the show, which is one of the great strengths and one of the most appealing parts of it as far as I'm concerned. But when you talk about if there was a weakness, let's say that computers just became 100 billion times faster tomorrow, which, we'll just say that happened, who would be the people to take action?
Well, the people that would take action would be the Bitcoin core developers. And when I was in Texas, somebody asked Andreas about, what happens if something happens to the core dev team. And he began to make a differentiation and say, there's not like a team of superheroes that comes up and, Satoshi dubs you a core developer for Bitcoin. A core developer for Bitcoin is anybody that's even put a period into the core code of Bitcoin. And this is done through BIPs or Bitcoin improvement plans. So there's a lot of core developers for Bitcoin. And even if something terrible were to happen to all of them, more people would come up and be like, oh, well, I read the white paper and I understand this. This looks pretty good. Let me try to put forth a Bitcoin improvement plan. And there's five different constituencies that will meet up between miners and various different people that are interested in the network. And there's basically voting and things like that within a very, very, very narrow margin of what's decided to be done. So basically, you control Bitcoin just as much as I do.
I see
so
that there are...
kind of like Wikipedia? Then, in terms of improving it and securing it, but, instead of just the mass populace, it'd be people who are very knowledgeable and skilled in that area.
Yeah, right now, but in the future, I think that everybody will have that skill set. I can't imagine a future in which we go towards actual accomplishing of real goals and overcoming struggles wherein that knowledge is not just known by almost everyone.
So, Blake, I'm looking at the Bitcoin.org development page. So it looks like there are really seven core developers who are responsible for the majority of the software development within Bitcoin. And then you can see Bitcoin QT contributors, and it looks like there may be about 100 of them. But... So largely, Bitcoin, you know, you have the Satoshi Nakamoto, who may or may, in my opinion,
he wrote the white paper and then assisted in the Genesis block creation.
Right, and he's been, there was a Business Week, or was it Newsweek, a Newsweek article.
Oh, man.
That outed him, and there's a lot of controversy around it. In my mind, he's the guy. He denies it, but there's just too many, there's too much corroborative data on to his career and, you know, what he's done. He's, I think is one of his sons has said he'll deny it till the day he dies. But you have this guy who was his last job was working with a credit card company, right? And developing software that enables or supports credit card transactions. And he dropped out of the private sector shortly after 9/11. And you had Bitcoin that came out. When did it come out? Was it 2009? Early 2009?
2008 was when the paper was published. And I don't believe that that is Satoshi for a second. Satoshi Nakamoto is like an Asian equivalent of John Doe.
Right. And there's that argument. There's that. I mean, that's a heated, you know, argument.
No, it is. And me and Andreas talked to some people in Texas about this. And Andreas said that he had gone and found various Amazon reviews written by this person and used software to examine the differences between those reviews and the white paper. And he said that, you know, this isn't conclusive, or don't quote me on this, so it's really nice that I'm doing this right now. But he said that he's quite confident that it's not the same person. And I've heard that discussed from a couple other sources as well.
And I've seen it both ways, you know, from your camp and then the opposite camp, right? So there's just kind of this, you know, a little bit of friction, you know, as to whether or not, I mean, because he worked in several government agencies, dropped out of the private sector. It's very coincidental that his name is, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto in real life. What is it, Dorian Satoshi Nakamoto? Is that his full name?
I believe so. I don't think that he is Satoshi, so I don't do a ton of search about him.
The bottom line is, does it matter?
No, it doesn't.
Because it's the code, how it's written, is open source in a manner, but it's refined and it's got to be approved by the core developers. And then through the increased encryption, as it carries on, it should be fail-proof. And I believe that's why, Blake, you fell in love with it right away. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, basically I was working at the financial institution, and somebody sent me an office communicator message saying, you know, this new technology was invented. And I was like, is it a hard technology or a soft technology? And he said, it's soft, but with massive physical implications. Just read this white paper. And when I read it, because my first thought, like many people's first thought, is, well, this is nonsense. Get here, let me read it, and I'll tell you why this is not going to work. Why, you know, data is easy to be copied, it can go everywhere. Why what are you even talking about? Give me the paper, I'll tell you why it can't be done. So I go through and I read it. And it's just like, oh, okay, this is ambitious. And then it's like, okay, this seems tenable. And then by the end, it's like, I can't. There's almost no way to describe how it felt after I finished. It was like discovering in the desert a giant pyramid made of just solid diamonds. Being like, well, somebody made this for a reason, and it looks pretty good. Maybe I should figure out some more about it, because somebody took a lot of effort. I feel like Satoshi is a pseudonym for sure, that it's not the real name of the creator. And I think that the level of polymathic brilliance that would be required to create a document like that is almost completely alien. So I'm not sure that the person that wrote it would expose themselves to any kind of risk, being that they developed the greatest risk management system ever conceived by billions of orders of magnitude. It seems completely incomprehensible to me.
Yeah, and I can agree. I agree with what you're saying there. But if you were indeed the guy, you would vehemently deny having any involvement, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. Definitely.
This individual or group of individuals who are behind the pseudonym, if it's one or more, how many bitcoins do they have? Is it $500 or $600 million worth? It's a decent amount.
I should probably know that, but I'm not sure.
it's a substantial amount. So if you out yourself, there are physical, you know, implications behind that, in addition to intellectual implications. So it's kind of a multi-layer type of situation, but
in addition to, you know, just outing yourself by saying, hey, I'm a, you know, multi-billionaire, or whatever the case might be, when I started to get really excited about Bitcoin was when I thought about the implications towards the Federal Reserve and all the standard banks and all the credit agencies and all the standing monetary systems that are out there right now. And the fact that all of the systems, the one thing that they have in common is the exposure to corruption, and all of the standing systems have people at the top that can control the way they can expand the money supply, they can contract it, you know. And that's what's so different about Bitcoin that really, really got me excited about it was the elimination of a person or a group of people to distort or manipulate the currency in and of itself. And
absolutely.
So, you know, and that's what, and so that when I heard that it was sort of like this anonymous thing, I mean, of course you wouldn't really want to take credit for it, because then you'd have to wonder, does that put your life at risk?
It puts your family at risk too.
Absolutely. I mean, that's how I would view it. And that would be my guess as to why it's been this anonymous creation.
Yeah, it's very dangerous for the establishment too.
Well, Bitcoin's not the only cryptocurrency. All the other ones that have come out, are there actually people that have said, I've created this, or are they all anonymous as well? What separates Bitcoin from the rest? Because I believe others have created others and claimed it, but...
Yeah, Charles Lee, he works for Coinbase. I met him down in Texas. He is the creator of Litecoin. He's a huge fan of Bitcoin and Litecoin, and I'm a huge fan of Bitcoin and Litecoin too. Litecoin is amazing. Litecoin is extremely important, even if you have an emotional attachment to Bitcoin and you really want nothing else to come along. You should give Litecoin a chance because it is necessary for instant scripted digital virtual arbitrage. Now, what is that? Arbitrage is the practice of taking something from a market where it is inexpensive to a market where it's expensive. It's probably one of the most ancient professions that exist. Delivery, basically. So when we have a new opportunity to exchange digital stores of value between multiple different exchanges through arbitrage instantaneously with no physical tangible material manipulation and delivery involved, that's a big deal. That's a very big deal that now we can have arbitrage happen completely instantly and really, really, really have connected, truly free, open market price competition and regularity. And if there's not, anybody that wants to can go practice digital arbitrage. And it's a fantastic free market anarcho solution to some of the world's oldest problems. And it's really exciting.
So when talking about Litecoin and the ability to utilize Litecoin more for arbitrage purposes, is this because of the fact that transactions can take place faster, or what gives it that utility?
What gives it the utility is that early on, it's not the hardest part of arbitrage is to convert things from cash to Bitcoin and from Bitcoin to cash. So to have an extra vehicle of digital store of value that you can convert back and forth Bitcoin to Litecoin with different exchanges, in addition to various different currencies, there are multiple different angles driving the arbitrage network, and it makes it instantaneously having an extra digital store of value there next to Bitcoin is extremely advantageous for, I guess, reasons that I could really ramble on for a long time about, but that would be kind of, super. Let's talk about microeconomics, everybody, and that's probably going to put everybody to sleep.
But it is, with Litecoin, isn't it... the ability to to complete a transaction, can't you do that a bit faster using Litecoin than Bitcoin?
Well, you can, and this kind of also touches on the reason that I like Bitcoin better than Litecoin. As a long-term store of value, Bitcoin is more secure than Litecoin. People might disagree with me, but I think that SHA is better than, you know, weak collision and MD5 and script and things like that.
But they can change that, right? I mean, you can change the cipher if you want, right?
But changing the cipher from script to something that is as developed as the secure hash algorithm would take a little bit more work. And also, people say that, you know, there's a feature set of Litecoin that it's ASIC proof. Well, it's not really ASIC proof. I mean, you could invest a lot of money in a memory intensive piece of hardware to really, really, really mine a lot of that stuff. But that's only going to be probably doable for either a nation state or somebody with a lot of money. So it kind of double defeats the purpose. Really, really, really makes a giant income disparity gap instead of a gradient like Bitcoin was able to rise through. And then in the end, you're also shooting yourself in the foot by having an ASIC-proof network and not having the amount of hash power that is behind securing the Bitcoin network.
So do you think, and, I've thought about it this way, and it'll be interesting to hear what your view on this. Do you think, well, probably when talking about cryptocurrency in general, Bitcoin to me is almost like Netscape in 1995. There's probably going to be a different version that's going to be, it's going to reach wide adoption.
I disagree.
Likely.
And I disagree in the argument of Band-Aid. Adhesive bandages are called Band-Aid. Band-Aid is the brand name for adhesive bandages. They're not even called adhesive bandages anymore. And that's what Bitcoin is for cryptocurrencies. And I think that it will be that way at least until the year 2140 as a result of these other feature sets coming along, some of them totally missing the point, some of them trying to do distribution type things. I mean, the entire point of Bitcoin, basically, if I have the hubris to, you know, crown it with one, is decentralization, just the essence of as decentralized as possible, not subject to, you know, centralizing forces of corruption and nonsense.
Well, and you just mentioned government state a little bit ago, and that would bring into why Bitcoin would last as well, because if new competing currencies came out that were highly encrypted like Bitcoin, very stable, but all of a sudden government states saw the future in cryptocurrency and they set up these huge warehouses to mine for the benefit of the government versus individuals. I think that would, I think the more and more cryptocurrencies that come out, the more it's set up to mine right away and it kind of, boxes it in. If that makes sense. But, Bitcoin, since it started, it was such a new invention, new thought process that, only people really interested caught on, and that's what kind of just spread it through there. And I don't know if I'm making any sense, but I can see the advantages of something new coming out, but also the disadvantages to where the, like you said, the Band-Aid is, it's the name sticks, and it carries on through there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, go ahead.
Oh, if I'm understanding you correct, Kirk, that does bring me to another question that I've had about it. What would prevent someone who has, let's say, you know, their net worth is, you know, $5 billion. What's to prevent them from throwing a bunch of resources at, you know, a bunch of supercomputers and then dominating the mining market? Is that something that could be a possible threat and then somebody could hoard all of them? Is that a possibility?
Well, since Bitcoin is deflationary and it's almost infinitely divisible, cornering the Bitcoin market is on paper the most ridiculous mathematical. I mean, it's actually funny when you go down and you do the math on, okay, it's this divisible. If somebody threw this much money at it, there's this much of it. Okay, that wouldn't work. Okay, let's take all the money on Earth. Okay, nope, that doesn't work. So basically every single resource on Earth would find an equilibrium within the Bitcoin blockchain in the value system of BTC because it's this is going to sound very, very, like I do have faith in Bitcoin or like I'm an evangelist here, but Bitcoin in the white paper, and when I read it and talked about this pyramid of diamond, it really is like that. All the edges are perfect. It is the pinnacle of the cryptocurrency concept, and I really strongly believe that any change of any part of the Bitcoin white paper represents negative progress. So any altcoin, I mean, you could have Bitcoin 2 and just copy it completely and start a new hash network, but people would probably attack it and kill it and flood it out. That can't happen with Bitcoin anymore. It's too big now. But any other system of cryptocurrency basically at this point represents negative progress by virtue of the fact that, well, they missed this or they missed that, or it's not the same hashing algorithm, or, well, there's this massive wealth distribution and pre-mining, or the constituencies which can change it are too limited, and it's a company or it's a small group of people and it's not truly decentralized. It's like we have the internet, and like if AT&T comes out and says, now we have the AT&T internet, you guys should use that. Some people will use it, but the people that really understand why the internet's so awesome are probably going to be like, I don't really want to use the AT&T internet or the NSA internet or, you know, the FedNet. I mean, it's a very similar situation with coins, and they will come out with, you know, FedCoin and whatever coin, and everybody will have coins, but it's like, go improve on Satoshi's white paper, and I think we could resurrect and clone Isaac Newton and ask him to do that, and he'd be like, oh, man, I can't. I'm not smart enough. So
you're... But I guess if I'm understanding what you're saying in terms of the potential concern, and maybe it's an invalid concern is what you're saying, about somebody being able, like, say, the U.S. government, they go, hey, this would be really good, and since our dollar's going down the toilet, maybe we should start mining Bitcoin and building up a reserve of those. You're saying that because the Bitcoins can be divided into, what is it, millionths of, like a millionth of a Bitcoin or a billionth
eight,
of a Bitcoin?
Eight decimal points, so it's infinitesimal.
100 millionths.
So 100 millionth of a Bitcoin. Because it has that feature, even if somebody wanted to hoard all the Bitcoins, it'd be kind of irrelevant because that would drive the price up, which would mean that each one of those, you know, 100 millionth or 100 billionth of a Bitcoin would be worth more, so it's an irrelevant.
Well, exactly,
so it's
but
not
it's
not really
just
a threat.
Irrelevant.
Is that what you're saying?
It's not just irrelevant. It's anti-fragile. It would help the person that did it and everybody else.
Yes. That's yes. Okay. All right.
But,
so I can't see that.
To go into what Chelsea's saying is, a government wouldn't just go out there and start mining it to hoard it because they just create their own currency.
Well, they might be both.
And that's what. I was waiting to bring this up, but I might as well bring it up now. The let's say the government that we have, we allow the Federal Reserve to create our money. What if the government created a competing currency, a cryptocurrency, to utilize as our welfare or infrastructure expenditures, where all government spending from now on uses this cryptocurrency? This new cryptocurrency, and we now accept it as taxes. Do you think that would hold gain ground? Or it's kind of similar to what's going on with the Aurora coin, but I haven't heard if Iceland's going to accept it for taxes or anything. But
yeah, it's an interesting experiment with Aurora coin. It's not the same as Bitcoin. It might, you know, it might work. It might not work.
But Aurora coin is not through the government, correct? That's some outside entity that created it?
I'm not sure what relationship the coders and the application software have with the government.
They have no relationship with the government.
Yeah, my theory is they just saw weak currency and a small population in a country that had a devalued currency this would be a great testing pool to do the air dump, give out the currency, see what happens, see if it works, see if it, you know, gets a hold in society and could replace this. I mean, but Iceland doesn't currently have a I don't think there is that their corona still, I don't think it's still through a central bank, is it? Or
yeah,
is
it's
it just
a central bank, and it's been substantially devalued in the last 5 years, and in fact a lot of the executive management within their central bank ended up going to prison because of the fact,
and some politicians too.
Yeah, so it's a country, you have a fairly affluent population that's fed up with government issued fiat currency, where if there's any place, Iceland is as good as any to give it a test run to see, you know, yep. All you have to do is say, here's my national security ID, you know, input the information into the Aurora coin system, and then you get, what is it, 30 or 35 Aurora coin, which right now is valued at around $10 per coin. It's been as high as $30, and, you know, see how the people use it.
Yeah, definitely. I'm Icelandic. I'm a direct descendant of Eskander Thorvald or Eric the Red. It's like probably the biggest part of my genetic heritage is Icelandic. So I'm a huge, huge fan of the Icelandic people. I think of them as my brothers and sisters for sure. I mean, I consider myself a citizen of the world. I don't try to be, you know, this nation's better and that nation's worse. But I have a soft spot in my heart for Iceland. And I think that, you know, I hope that it does work for them. And I think that if it can work anywhere, that's probably a really, really good place to start trying.
Do you think it's interesting seeing the number of people that are getting turned on to Bitcoin and really enthusiastic about it, and then the number of countries in the world that have basically kicked out the current banking system, like Iceland and Russia and a handful of others, that are saying, no, we're not doing this debt-based thing anymore. We're not going to subjectify ourselves to these fraudulent practices, and we're done with it.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that. I'm very excited about that. In Iran, when there was crippling, you know, acts of crimes against humanity going on, imposed on Iran, there was a giant surge of Bitcoin purchases that came out of Iran, and I think that that's fantastic. In Argentina, the Argentinian peso is just crippling people's ability to survive, and basically Argentina's like, no! No diversification, no alternative currencies. That's how we're going to solve the problem. And that just, you know, Bitcoin use has exploded in Argentina. I mean, the government, you know, continually announcing that people shouldn't and can't do that just drove purchases through the roof. I mean, the worst thing that governments can do is come out and tell people don't buy Bitcoin. Like, I wish that the United States government would come out and say don't buy it, but they try to attack it on the fringe and stuff like that to try to see what's going to happen with it and how they can best prepare to make money off of it. And I think that the banks right now are probably talking in a one-way unilateral conversation with our representatives, trying to figure out how to impose regulations that will capture business and crush small competition and how they can make money off Bitcoin too.
But how about the banks that are, you know, if Bitcoin or cryptocurrency really gains mass adoption, it really threatens the transaction fees that yep. are kind of the cash cow with credit card companies or for credit card companies. So like Visa, MasterCard, Discover, yeah, American.
50% of small business overhead goes to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So certain businesses.
So how?
Yeah,
how
not my business. I'll give you a big old zero.
good for you. Good for you.
How do they embrace that? I mean, are they going to, you know, go...
It's similar to Andrea said that the TCPIP Internet Protocol Suite and all of that, basically the internet came along and the telco companies were like, no, analog is much better. We don't need any of that stuff. We're going to have analog. And then one telco was like, oh, we can have one T1 with 24 phone lines in it, and then the 25th line can be a logical switching line. We're going to do that. We can now pull 25 times less cable. Every other telco then was like, oh, we can't afford to do anything else. And boom, there, you know, the internet's here. So that's going to happen with banking. And
so it's a technological inevitability, basically, is what that argument means.
Oh, what's that?
It's just a technological inevitability.
Yeah, exactly. This giant net of value is here, and the system is collapsing into it. Nothing else can happen, in my view.
I'd just like to reiterate one thing that gold, why people always consider gold as universal or a value that's so stable is the fact that it's universal. And that's the power of cryptocurrency. It is worldwide. It's global. It can be taken anywhere with you and stored electronically, so you don't even have to carry anything.
Yeah, Bitcoin is not American. It is global.
And so that's why most people most Americans see it like, well, we, you know, why would I change out of the dollar? You know, we have, but that's because we are Americans and we have the world based currency in the world. So
yeah, we have the world reserve currency. All trade needs to be conducted on an international global level in dollars. I mean, you see what happens to people that don't use dollars the way that we say that they should. I mean, Saddam Hussein, we got to get rid of him. He's not using dollars. He's got, you know, weapons of mass destruction. Or let's go into Libya.
Putin,
they
now
wanted to have the gold dinar. We got to go. We got to go get him out of there. He's all of a sudden so terrible that we can't tolerate him anymore. So.
Yeah, and that's why I think a lot of this stuff with Russia is going on right now, too, because Russia's been trying to get away from the dollar as well, as the way I see it, I guess. But
yep,
well, our historical track record for getting involved in foreign affairs has really nothing to do with our surface concern for human rights. I mean, if that were really the case, how come we, you know, have been such good friends with Saudi Arabia for such a long time? I mean, it's very clear that the stated intentions are not the actual intentions. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the economic warfare instead of actually giving a crap about how someone's, you know, living in another country or whether their, you know, dictator is treating them wrong.
Absolutely. There's a great book by Carol Quigley called Tragedy and Hope, and basically it's goes on to describe how the real history of this world is a financial one. What are finances? What are markets? They're human action. You want to describe quantifiable human action, that's what economics are. Go back and figure out what really happened.
So let's hash on that a little bit. What you said intrinsic value.
Intrinsic value.
Yeah, sorry. So the only thing that gains Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency value is just because we value it.
Supply and demand. It's the only thing that gives anything any value.
And trust.
Except for by decree with violence, which is really an abhorrent solution to anything. So.
Yeah, so, well, and that leads me back to why, let's say America decided to come out with their own cryptocurrency called the American coin or something. And they said all social welfare programs we will pay in this cryptocurrency instead of taking people's dollars and then dishing them out, you know, redistribution of wealth or whatnot. They just create a certain amount of coins every year and dish them out to the needy or whatnot and for certain projects that the government deems necessary. And we can elect and de-elect politicians as, you know, around that cryptocurrency as well, too, because they would be forced into keeping it stable. They couldn't just go out there and say, oh, this year we're going to print a million American coins. The next year we're going to create 10 million or a billion because, you know, why not? There's no intrinsic value behind it anyways. So, but then it would destabilize it. So,
well,
the faulty of the process would be exposed is what I was thinking, but.
Well, I agree with where you're going here, but what that would look like is Uncle Sam backing up in front of all of this awesome stuff, like jet skis and toys and all this stuff, backing up, trying to keep the crowd away from all the cool stuff and being like, okay, well, we'll get that stuff. I see that there's a need for this for you guys to come over and get it. Help me figure out how you made that all and then continue to stick with me instead of just running past me to use all the stuff that's already here. And that's a very, very, very difficult situation for Uncle Sam to manage, I think.
Yeah, I just see it as a way for government, for, you know, I've always leaned more conservative, but very more libertarian these days. And then the liberal aspect of redistribution of wealth, and it's not a fair system. It's not a sustainable system. And but in a way, I could see a cryptocurrency working as such that they do something like Iceland, where it's an airdrop to the needy of the country. And if you can still pay your taxes in that coin versus the competing Federal Reserve note, so you could use either one, so all businesses would still accept it, so they could still, you know, use that American coin to pay their taxes or whatnot that year, vice versa. So it's as long as the government which you reside allows you to pay it in taxes, it could be a viable currency.
Well, definitely. I think that the future is going to belong to information scientists and computer scientists and technology. And I think that what they're going to do is they're going to eventually figure out that the Constitution is pretty neat, but really what we need to do is have supreme respect and regard and laws to protect people's negative rights. And then the one positive right, which is more important than any other positive right could ever be argued to be, which is the right to retain the fruits of your labor. Because if you do not have the right to retain the fruits of your labor, somebody coming and taking the fruits of your labor is effectively retroactive enslavement. So you move the cart and the horse around on a system of enslavement and then act like it's progress, and it's just absolutely ridiculous. It's just despicable.
No. I'd like that term, retroactive enslavement. I tried breaking this down to a friend of mine and saying, do you realize that for the majority of us, I probably work 6 months a year for free?
Yep. Absolutely.
For absolute free.
Yep.
And what people don't pay attention to, they might pay attention to the federal income tax rate, and then they completely forget, oh, well, there's 7.65% that comes out of your paycheck for Medicare and Social Security, and then on the other side, what you're not seeing is your employer also has to kick in another 7.65% for Social Security and Medicare, and then you have state income taxes, and then you have sales tax, and then you have all the taxes that are wrapped into the price of the items that you buy. So if you're buying a product from a C corporation, then that price is effectively, you know, 40% higher than it should be because you have to cover their tax bill.
Absolutely.
You know, and so on and so forth. And so when you really break it down, most people work half the year for free. I mean, if you want to talk about enslavement, that's the perfect term for it, retroactive enslavement.
Absolutely. When you die, then you're done, right? Oh, no, then they get death tax. So then they get you one more time.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a few thoughts on specifically Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general, but a few things that a few topics have come up more and more over the last probably half year or so is the volatility associated with Bitcoin. So you got up to $1,100 or $1,200 a Bitcoin briefly, and then on Gox exchange within the last month or month and a half got down to 150, and other exchanges obviously they're quite a bit higher. So
Gox went down that far because Gox collapsed in a spectacularly embarrassing and highly preventable fashion. So basically, Bitcoins went up as high as $1,800 per coin on local Bitcoins, and then Gox, with all of its publicity, decided to just melt and die of Ebola in a public town square screaming, Bitcoin did this, and everybody stood back in horror going, oh gosh, that's not good. Holy crap, we don't want that. So, I mean, people will recover from that, and right now there's not really a great exchange to, you know, trade lots and lots of massive volumes of Bitcoin with. I mean, you can go to Coinbase, but they're a financial services institution. They are the payment service provider for Overstock.com. So Coinbase is a great place to buy Bitcoins. I think you should all go there and buy some. But, like, if hedge funds want to buy a lot of Bitcoin and stuff like that, we need to establish a Bitcoin exchange in New York. Legislators in New York are talking about that, getting one that's regulated and set up there. And, you know, some people take issue with this, but I kind of say, well, it's like, you know, let's have a rent-a-cop next to the, you know, fat kid's table in the park with the pogs on it so no one can come and punch him in the nose and take his pogs. It's not the worst idea in the world. So once we get that exchange opened up in New York and people can trade Bitcoins back and forth, I think that that will drive the price up. Remember that Mt. Gox was so horrifyingly badly programmed that it was a trading platform for a global currency that wasn't able to handle 7 trades per minute. 7 trades per minute.
So how did it become the most favored exchange?
It worked, and there were big signs, and the big Bitcoin community kept saying, well, no, don't do business with Mt. Gox. Some people that knew Karpelos were, you know, he's a nice guy, he's a family man, I don't think he's going to rip me off, so I'm going to give him a little bit more of my faith. Other people in the community that were like, I live my life by risk management standards, and maybe that makes me an asshole, but this is not good. I mean, the Trilateral Commission and David Rockefeller got all this money together to do all this research about Western Europe and North America and Japan, and the results of what he found out there are something that people should probably be familiar with relative to investing in Japan. I mean, Japan has some angst when it comes to opinions of the West, and I really can't blame them. And I don't think that that's why this happened at all, but just in general, as far as, oh, there's a company in Japan, I'm going to start sending them thousands of dollars and expect thousands of dollars back and things like that with international laws. It's just the entire thing was an absolute nightmare. So this exchange was effective enough in its crippling state of dysfunction to drive the price, not single-handedly, but it had a major role in driving the price of Bitcoin up 40,000% in 24 months. So once an exchange opens up in New York that's capable of doing 100,000 transactions per second, imagine what that's going to do to the price.
And there are people like Mark Andreessen and others who are working on exchanges like this that will have some, you know, level of trust and I think that's the big thing with Bitcoin is that people look at it and they're like, I read an article that said that you should expect Bitcoin to be 7 times more volatile than gold, and that you shouldn't put any money in Bitcoin that you can't afford to lose. So, and this is kind of, you know, this is what money managers are telling their clients, saying, well, go for it, but I wouldn't do it. In my mind, you know, first of all, you have to have reputable, secure exchanges in place.
Yep.
And then primarily, you need to have the market cap there where you can't have a Goldman Sachs or any other institution go in and start shorting Bitcoin so you can drive it up or down at their whim. Because if you're dealing with a market cap of $8 billion, you can get a JP Morgan or a Goldman Sachs in there and they can make it as volatile as they want, right?
Well, yeah, but volatility in Bitcoin isn't really something that concerns the Bitcoin community, because a lot of us like to be like, oh, look, it just swung down 3%. Let me go ahead and buy some. Oh, it swung up 3%. Let me liquidate some. And you can continually day trade with swings that are much more profitable than any of, you know, the NASDAQ or the Dow or anything. It's like, oh, the Dow hit 15,000. Look at how great we're doing. It's like, oh, that's not inflationary. That's pretty cool. I have no idea how you did that. I mean, it's like you print more and more and more and more money, and then more money has to chase after the same products, and then you hit, you know, record stock highs. And it's like, this is like a bad joke. What are you – this is transparent, but I know not everybody can see through it, because I think that a lot of people know that it's a farce and they don't really want to subject themselves to the pain of being like, yep, I proved to myself that it's a farce. So a lot of people just tend to completely shut it out. And with Bitcoin, since there's not a giant inflationary false crutch of stability, it's much more volatile, but that's how a currency that's traded around the world should be. There should be lots of up and down swings, but it should always be kind of deflationary and going up. And that's definitely the pattern that Bitcoin has adopted. It's always 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 3 steps forward, 1 or 2 steps back, 4, and then it, you know, keeps going up more and more and back less and up more and back less.
But that volatility scares Joe Sixpack.
It does.
For day traders, you know, if you look at the VIX on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, for day, they love, you know, the volatility is a day trader's best friend. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, Joe Sixpack at home, he or she wants to look at it and say, well, it's holding its value. It's doing what it should do. And a lot of people who, you know, look at it and who started looking at it, they're like, well, it just goes up and down so much. And that, you know, that keeps some people, it just makes them leery, you know, of cryptocurrency in general, Bitcoin and, you know.
Well, here's my argument to that is that I like Bitcoin just for the thought process of it, or the reality of it. That it's non-inflationary, there's a finite value, it's global, universal, there's no centralized planning authority behind it. And so you have to me, it's still a currency. yeah, there are currency traders out there, but the vast use of currency is not for investment. And right now, Bitcoin, to me, is looked as an investment. And I think that's going to, it's kind of what leads that volatility scare and people's general malaise in getting involved in it, because, you know, maybe it'll just crash in value. But the idea behind it is what gives it so much value. And that's why, like Blake said at the beginning, where, you know, would you take a cube of gold or all the information in the world? And I think this Bitcoin is a new revelation in that utilizes our technology advancement. This is like the best, besides the internet, this is like the next best technological advancement of our current era, is what I look at it as.
I agree, and I was just thinking the other day that the internet is the ability for us all to have the coffee shop in our pocket to go and talk about politics or science or anything. We can all communicate any idea pretty much instantaneously. And with this giant, giant lattice of subconsciousness out there, it was able to create the right mix of information in Satoshi's brain to birth something really out of him, but out of the entire internet itself as well. And what was birthed out of this rapid technological expansion is so alien that there are definitely a set of people on this earth that no matter how much they study Bitcoin, they will never be able to understand it.
One thing that should be noted too, though, that Bitcoin is relatively new, and the amount of bitcoins that are out there right now are relatively small in comparison to the total number of bitcoins that will be mined.
It's already at 50%, I think, isn't it? Or
is it 50%?
They were made fast at first, and they slowed down to create a system of deflation and reward for early adopters so that they could quit their jobs and code it. The incentive system for Bitcoin is absolutely brilliant.
Okay, so earlier it was my understanding that over time it will become a little bit more stable, that while there's 50% out there, if we're going to say it's at 50% now, then if there's a scare or a panic, it would take less people to panic to be able to make it fluctuate than it would when they're all released.
Exactly. As adoption spreads out, it will naturally stabilize, and these 3% swings that we see today will move to much smaller percent swings. But since it is a free market currency, I mean, it will never be as stable as like the Dow, because the Dow is not, it's not real. And I was going to also jump back to what you were mentioning about people investing versus people treating it like a currency. And I kind of agree and I disagree. I am invested in Bitcoin as a long-term store of value. And I believe that a lot of people think of Bitcoin as a stock, which is a very convenient way of kind of explaining it on a very, very, very generalistic level. But Bitcoin is not a stock. A stock is a share in a company's future earnings that can be badly managed to zero overnight. Bitcoin is a literally default-free math-based securities future commodity. It's really hard to label these different things.
And a lot of people have put capital into Bitcoin, so they don't want to see that washed away either. So there will always be that value to it to people, no matter how much bad news or however it's driven downward in price, it should rebound every time.
Definitely. And the reason that I say that it's a default free currency and that I said that gold wasn't is because now there's this paper market for gold. There's this that can't happen with Bitcoin unless people allow it to happen. Bitcoin has the IOU and the actual commodity fused inseparably together. So there's no reason to ever be like, hey, I'm going to give you an IOU for some Bitcoins. It's like, okay, well, if we want to have a lending situation, that's fine. But I'm never going to ever accept paper instead of my Bitcoins with the knowledge that somebody has an account on my behalf somewhere. And I think that the world needs to get more used to that. There are companies coming up that make it easier to secure your stuff. CryptoCorp, Ryan Singer, just a genius guy. So CryptoCorp has some great solutions on how to keep this stuff secure.
So what's the best way to use Bitcoin? What kind of wallets or what electronic wallets or what do you utilize, Blake? What's new out there?
Well, I like Coinbase a lot. And I use Coinbase a lot. I also like to use Bitcoins to buy things from Tiger Direct and Overstock.com. Even if you can't afford Bitcoins but want to support the community somehow, shop even with cash at Tiger Direct and Overstock. So.
And could I quickly, before we completely miss this point, one thing I know you mentioned towards the beginning here, you were saying a lot of people that like to diversify will go into gold, and these are people that are very well informed. They've done the research. Now, one thing that really is a benefit that I see to Bitcoin opposed to gold is that I know some people, I won't name names, that are trying to get some of their wealth outside of the borders of the United States. And one thing that's a difficulty right now is that when you go through customs, they ask you how much money are you bringing with you.
Exactly.
And you have to report it. And whenever you're making a tax payment, whether that's through Minnesota e-services online or whether that's through EFTPS to the federal government, they always ask you, is this coming from a financial institution outside the United States? Or when you do your taxes, they say, do you own any foreign bank accounts? Do you own a corporation that has a foreign bank account? And they want to know all of these things, right?
Yeah.
For a good reason. Now, with the Bitcoin, you can go through customs. You don't have to report anything because it goes wherever you go. And that's
Absolutely.
Another really beautiful thing. So, like, let's say that America completely falls apart tomorrow. As long as you can get your physical being out of the United States, your money will follow you wherever you go.
It's almost in a different dimension. So it's not like you took it out of the U.S. for purposes of transporting
exactly.
it around. It's just it became a digital store of value.
Exactly. So you don't have to worry about trying to carry it across the border ever.
Absolutely. It's going to change everything.
Lydia, I think your mute came off.
Shoot, sorry.
So getting back to the volatility issue, and I'm sure you've had this conversation more than a few times, Blake.
No, I love talking about it.
Yeah. How does that end? I mean, is there, because we're looking at a market cap of close to $8 billion right now for Bitcoin, which is very small. What figure needs to be reached in order to really blunt, you know, a lot of the volatility? And I think that's really what keeps a significant amount of people out of that market in general.
Well, I think that volatility is a concern, but I think that the biggest reason that there are not billions of dollars flowing into Bitcoin all the time right now is because the New York Exchange is not open yet. And basically, if you manage a hedge fund, you have to comply with various risk management strategies. And going to any of the exchanges that are open right now, I have a feeling that they would violate risk management strategies that are within the framework of how these various institutions have to run. So yeah, I mean, volatility will help to bring average consumers in, but when the full tide of Western speculation starts dumping into Bitcoin, when this exchange opens, that's when people, regardless of how volatile it is, are going to be like, it's going up, I want to get in on that. And it'll just become very ubiquitous at that point, I believe.
Well, is it going to become
that kind of? I actually haven't been aware of a pending New York exchange, but the Winklevoss brothers, they're pretty emphatic about the fact that they see Bitcoin going to $40,000 per Bitcoin. You know, we're looking at Bitcoin today, it's $621. And, you know, so basically, if you have, you know, pending exchanges or exchanges that are going to be able to handle securely, a large amount of transactions, we're really still looking at, you know, if someone wants to get into Bitcoin, you're looking at getting in at the ground floor still.
Oh, yeah. Bitcoin is such an infant that it's almost inexplicable. This is before there are giant financial markets that are going to take this and turn it into what the telcos did to the internet. This is, like, if 10% of COMEX trade comes to be represented in Bitcoin, that's way over 1.5 million per Bitcoin. 10% of one.
So it's going to be the Berkshire Hathaway of
It's going to be big. Yeah. It's going to be big, man. And that'll bring up the price of all other altcoins, too. So even if you're not holding onto the right one, they all kind of rise together. Like, I believe that Litecoin will always be a percentage value of Bitcoin, and then subsequent altcoins without various, you know, strong differences in their feature sets will always kind of have a fractional representation of other altcoins.
Do you mine Bitcoins, Blake?
Do I mine Bitcoins? I do. I do run mining equipment, and it's fascinating to go and talk to industry leaders. When I was in Texas last week, I went down and I interviewed the CEO of CoinTerra. They make the most powerful application-specific integrated circuit hashing computers on Earth. This guy was the lead chip architect for Samsung. Somebody told him about Bitcoin. 3 weeks later, he quit his job. He had a house in escrow. They didn't give him the house. He started CoinTerra. For the first 3 months, he was the only employee. He made a new ASIC chipset that reached tape out from development in 49 days, and then basically put all of his money into the supply chain with other venture capitalists to get all the stuff before they even were able to test it to secure the network as fast as he possibly could. So that's the kind of person that got into Bitcoin early.
why I brought it up is the mining. I've heard that the mining's kind of pointless to get into, though, now. It's so integrated through larger companies getting involved now. Or do you disagree? Or do you think you should focus on other cryptocurrencies if you were to start mining?
Well, that's true and false. So let's say you have an FPGA miner or a field programmable gate array or a graphics card. You have your graphics card. What you should do is there's something you can go on. You can go on Google. There's some software. I haven't tried it yet. You might want to do some research that will find what is the most profitable altcoin to mine right now using an FPGA, and then it automatically converts it into Bitcoin as fast as it can. That's pretty much what a lot of the altcoins are doing right now. They're mining and then dumping into Bitcoin. So then they're this, you know, root system that's coming out from the network. So people say don't mine Bitcoin directly because it's not worth it. Well, you know, maybe it won't be, but if Bitcoin goes to, you know, a million, it retroactively makes your mining more valuable. So imagine a bell curve on its side, and then you have an X and a Y axis. So it starts to go up, it goes out and up, and then it goes up, and then it starts actually arching back in time. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you were to tell any economist, hey, look at this outlook projection for my investment, they'd be like, that's ridiculous, you're fired. So
why I was bringing it up is, what do you think of like cloud hashing or somewhere? It's a business that you pay X amount of dollars a year and they mine for you. Do you think that's even a worthy investment right now, or that's just something that would gain interest? Or do you think it'd be better to do the graphics processor way? Or, I mean,
if you're interested, you should do all of these things. You should diversify even within the world of cryptocurrencies. And CloudHash.com is directly across the hall from CoinTerra. They're in the same building suite in Austin, Texas. And Luke Jr. was coming out of CloudHash.com as I walked up, and I, you know, stuffed my hand into his chest and was like, I'm Blake Anderson, good to meet you. And he has been central in programming various different software for the Bitcoin community. So it's really cool to meet him. And I think CloudHash.com is a great company. I think that people should probably buy mining contracts from them. I mean, I would. I'm not, you know, a financial analyst. I'm not trying to give people financial advice. Really, I would say a good strategy with Bitcoin is if you have Bitcoin and it goes down a lot because of some kind of disaster, which I don't see another one coming after Gox was so epic. But what you have to do is hold on to it until the deflationary winch on the Titanic keeps pulling in that bungee cord, and then eventually you'll be solvent again and then even probably making money.
So for question, if someone like, you know, myself wants to kind of get into the Bitcoin type of investment, is it better to, you know, $620 right now is, you know, to me it's not really a lot of money, because, you know, when I invest in stocks, you know, it's about the amount of capital I put in there. So is it better to just pay the money now if we're going to see that this going up, or should we invest into equipment to mine it? Because I see that equipment will cost a lot of money as well, too.
Well, at this point, there were three different stages of mining. The first stage of mining was CPU mining, the very, very infancy of Bitcoin, to give people that were going to adopt it as an academic experiment very, very early. We wanted, the intent of that was to have lots of Bitcoin mined during this time, make it so that those people can retire from everything else that they're doing and have all of their time left over to research and develop this digital store of value.
Which is what you've done.
Well, yeah, which is definitely what I did, but I didn't get in that early. I was almost kind of at the end of the FPGA race.
Mm-hmm. Who's doing that noise?
Danny.
Is that me? What
it's
noise?
It's pretty annoying. Yes, whatever that was.
It's probably the computer.
Sounded like scratching.
That sounds like Bitcoin mining to me.
I was just mining some Bitcoins with my abacus over here.
Ancient style.
Like chalk on a chalkboard.
Yeah. All right, enough of that. So, anyways.
So I guess, if I start today, should I, would you recommend to just, buy at $620 and not worry about investing all the equipment and
from my personal subjective opinion, I would say that right now your best bet would be to go to Coinbase.com, open up an account, link it to your bank account, and then put in $20 a day or however much you want. If it dips down, buy, and probably just get some Bitcoin in that way. If you want to mine, it's a lot of fun, but there is a learning curve. There are considerations that you need to know. At this point, ASIC mining equipment, one unit that is, basically one of the best, will take two complete power circuits in your home. One circuit, there's two power supplies within each miner. Each power supply requires the full use of one electrical circuit. So for most people in their home, that is instantly not doable. It's very, very loud. And it produces enough heat to probably heat your entire home. So
right. It sounds like, if I was to invest into equipment, the cost of doing it seems to outweighs plus, the time commitment that you have to deal with. I mean, the mining, the computer probably does it automatically, but, the time commitment involved as well as risking burning your house down and things like that. It sounds to me it's probably best to just put money in there right now, since it's, it's still kind of relatively low, and we can see the potential of, the price shooting high,
I agree, and I think that it would be nice to have some hashing power through CloudHash or whoever, and to try to get it before the price starts to go really, really, really not so high off the chain, because having mining power in hand for one of those situations is what makes you a lot of money. Because usually when that situation happens, then everybody starts going to buy mining equipment, and then there's a year-long queue, and by the time that you get it, it's almost too little too late. So I'm very adept at buying mining equipment because I can actually go in and look at math-based security, specific application, specific integrated circuits, and look at their project baselines and plans and stuff and be like, is this a tenable plan? Can I vet this plan and have it look realistic, or are these people really not realistic about what they're saying? So I have an advantage in that way.
You have to keep
as far as mining equipment is concerned, because you kind of focus a bit on ASICs boxes that are specifically designed to mine Bitcoin, correct?
Correct. Yep, I have basically they're TerraMiner 4s. You can go to cointerra.com and you can look at them. They're designed to be racked in a data center, and they're really not for home use. I have office space above a giant industrial center so that we have all the power that we would need, and basically like a massive, massive 30,000 BTU heat mitigation cooling system running 24/7 on them. So that office, the space, the rent, all of that overhead associated with mining on your own is definitely a limiting factor at this point. But if you think that Bitcoin is going to go up, as much as I do, it wouldn't be absurd to use your computer to mine some and then hold on to it, and then, it'll be worth, $500-$600 in 24, 48, 50 months or something like that.
But don't you also have to keep up up to date with like mining equipment as well, because you know technology changes so rapidly. I mean, aren't there costs associated to get the most latest technology to mine as much as as quick as possible? I mean, I see that there's a limiting factor to that too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you have to continually upgrade your equipment. You could get like a block eruptor USB stick that gets red hot that'll hash out some nice power, but what you want to do is look at what is the least amount of money that I can pay per gigahash. 1,000 gigahashes makes 1 terahash. So like $3 per gigahash, $6 per gigahash, $10 per gigahash. Figure out how to get the most mining power for your money, and then you will be able to run it for the longest amount of time before you have to upgrade. But you're probably going to want to use some of your profits to upgrade before that time comes anyway.
Sure.
What's the average return per gigahash? Or terahash or whatnot. Is there anything like that? Can you assume a certain return, or is it pretty
big?
Well,
right now, I'm trying to think off the top of my head if 1 terahash is like $75 a day or something like that in cash that it would make you. And then you'd want to assume basically a flat return. So the amount of competition for mining is going to go up, so your amount of Bitcoins will go down that you get, but also the value of Bitcoin should go up. So you want to kind of assume a straight or flat even rate of return. The first generation of miners that I ever got, I assumed a flat even rate of return when the price was at $8. So when the price went, way, 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 way high, it completely exited all of my projections. And then my, plan for the worst, hope for the best scenario just, came through. And I have a feeling that no matter how things go, that this is going to be a continuing trend in different stores of digital value.
Yeah, I'm just looking at which one is this, Cloud Hashing here. Their platinum level is $9,000 per year, and that's for terahashing per second. So that would be, if you average out $75 a day, you'd double your money in a year, I guess.
Yeah, it's an extremely strong investment.
But that that just leads me into the crux of a problem I have with Bitcoin. Is what is your – you've gone to these Bitcoin conferences. What's the attitude of people? Do people talk about making dollars, or do they really believe in this Bitcoin debt-free currency that they would rather have the Bitcoin than the dollars that they're making, that the Bitcoin is going to – because – our dollars are inflationary, and it's going to be devalued over time. And the dollar value isn't anything but just an extra cap, I guess, by being ahead of the curve, by having this sound-based currency that's going to hold its value relative to the dollar or any other currency, to where all of a sudden you can be richer. It's like you go to another country and your exchange rate just doubled. I mean, so that's where it's like, do people really value the, the Bitcoin numbers they have, or do they value the dollars they're making from it?
Well, right now, there used to be a payment system called Dwolla that would allow you to instantly convert your Bitcoin into cash the second that it was mined. Dwolla was shut down by the SEC. No, not by the SEC, by like the NSA or Homeland Security or somebody that has no right to go into financial markets at all. So that wasn't cool. But now you would need to go through and sell your coins in another way. You can probably automate that too, I guess, by now. But the overwhelming opinion that I got at the Texas Bitcoin Conference during the mining press conference with all, some of the top miners was, would you guys all keep doing this if it wasn't profitable? And almost everybody raised their hand. And people mine because mining, along with the longer you can afford to hold your coins, is a pragmatic way to behave. It's a pragmatic thing to do. It would be anti-pragmatic to liquidate your coins right away because the time preference relative to Bitcoin is just so insane. I mean, if Gox could push the price 40,000% in 24 months, you could spend and liquidate some of your Bitcoin, and then 2 weeks later, you'd want to kill yourself. So,
right now, so whatever you do right now is probably still a good time to get into the game if you guys are interested. So, I think,
Yeah, it sounds like from what Blake's saying, either dollar cost average into Bitcoin.
Yeah, that works.
Or mine, you know, whatever, or potentially the combination of the two.
And mining at this point is, I mean, I don't want to alienate anybody, but some people have called it a race between computer scientists at this point. And if that's not a race that you want to be in, I wouldn't subject yourself to it.
So in your opinion, dollar cost averaging is the most comfortable way for, you know, for someone who's looking to get into Bitcoin to go about the process.
I think so. As time goes on, there might be a time in the future when we go back and listen to this and like, wow, that was really bad advice, but
yeah.
I guess I'll have to take that risk.
Well, Warren Buffett said, you know, dollar costing average is a good way to do things as well, because, you know, if it goes down, you can buy more, and if it goes up, you know, you buy less. But, you know, it's a pretty conservative way of, you know, of investing. So, you know, if you ever read The Intelligent Investor, you know, they talk about, you know, how dollar costing average is actually something that's pretty useful. So I can see that, you know, applies to Bitcoin as well. So
definitely. I like Jim Rogers a lot. I think of him as my Warren Buffett. So.
All right, Kirk, you ready to wrap it up?
We went a little bit over.
Yeah, is there, yeah, we went a little over, but I think it's been very interesting and really happy you joined us this evening, Blake. Hope to meet you in person someday.
Absolutely, it'd be fun to meet up. It's I'm writing an article about the Texas Bitcoin Conference, and basically it starts out with, in the beginning was the self, and looking around it said I, and everything that's ever happened in my life between then. So I have to try to chop it down a little bit, because once you start writing in a gonzo journalistic style, oh man. But it's been a great conversation. Yeah, it just becomes a mental party, I guess. A little bit of schizophrenia.
All right, it's been a fun evening. I hope we accomplished a little knowledge in the cryptocurrency, and I look forward to the next topic we have. So,
absolutely.
Till next week.
Yeah, thanks much.
Take care.